Blog Talk Radio.
Y'all ready to ride? Take a ride round the block now. Every day seeing dope fiends and the cops round. At any traffic stop, we could be shot down. And in the courts, it's just us. Justice is not fair.
Good evening, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to Injust Us, a show that listeners can share their stories of injustice, ask questions, and seek advice. Each week, we feature guests who are making a difference in the Black community. My name is Melinda Robertson, and I am your host and a member of the WPGR All-Female Radio Network. I'm an author, activist, mother, and grandmother from Washington, D.C. In addition, I am the founder of Black Mothers for Justice, Inc., a 501c3 nonprofit organization created to provide a safe space where mothers can talk openly about their child's conviction without being judged and learn how to cope with the hurt, pain, shame, and guilt they tend to carry. The mission is to connect Black mothers to the city and state to state so they can stand together in solidarity against an unfair and unjust judicial system. Over the weekend, I had the distinct pleasure of participating in a women's empowerment forum via Zoom and spoke about a Black mother's pain. This is a snippet from my speech. Black mothers carry burdens that no other race of women have had to bear. The pain Black mothers have endured goes back to slavery. When they were raped by the slave owners, their children were snatched from them to be bought and sold on auction blocks, and they witnessed their sons being cut down from trees. Today, Black mothers are experiencing a different kind of pain at the hands of the criminal justice system. This Friday, July 3rd, 2020, Black Mothers for Justice, Inc. will be hosting a virtual meeting for mothers of inmates who are suffering in silence during this pandemic. They have been unable to visit their sons and daughters for months, and are going days, sometimes weeks, without hearing from them. And the fear of COVID-19 weighing heavy on their hearts. Please spread the word about this meeting for mothers of inmates via Zoom on this Friday from 4 to 6. The dial-in information can be found on my Instagram and Facebook pages under author Melinda Robertson. Tonight's guest, Hugh Burton from Bronx, New York, was 16 years old when he was convicted of killing his own mother. He was coerced into confessing to committing this heinous crime and spent nearly 20 years in prison before he was exonerated with the help of the Innocence Project. He has a powerful testimony, but before I introduce Hugh, I am going to read a current event that took place last week. A Chicago man has been charged for fatally shooting two teens after they asked how tall he was. Police say Leroy Battle, 19, opened fire on two teens in an alley around 5 p.m. on Saturday, June 20th. According to Chief Brendan Denahan, the shooting took place after the two teens and a friend had a brief encounter with Battle, whom they did not know, in a corner store. The victims commented because Battle was quite tall, and they asked how tall he was because they hoped to be that tall someday. Unfortunately, obviously, we'll never see the full growth of these poor children. As the three teens walked home, two of them were shot multiple times in the alley. Police said they recovered 9 shell casings from the scene. Jashawn Francis, 17, was shot in the back, chest, and left hand and taken to University of Chicago Hospital where he died. Charles Riley, 16, was shot in the back and left leg and was taken to University of Chicago Hospital, where he also died. Police said the two boys asked their mothers if it was okay to go down to the block to buy candy from the corner store. He was just a kid, said Francis, his aunt Latoya. He liked video games and snacks. That was his thing. He would walk into the hospital gift shop and buy and purchase snacks daily. He was nice to the seniors on the block, and the nurses looked forward to him coming there daily. They brought over family roses. They watched him grow up as a child. Battle was charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder. Police said he had a previous conviction for aggravated unlawful use of a weapon, for which he received probation. Please keep these black mothers and their families in prayer and pray to get these guns out of the hands of these reckless and ruthless young people who have absolutely no regard for life. Without further ado, please welcome Hugh Burton to the show.
Hello, Hugh. How are you? How's everything? Yes.
I'm good, Hugh. How are you this evening?
I'm doing good. I'm doing well. How's everything going? Good?
Yes, we're good. Thanks. We're good. I want to remind the listeners to press 1 if you would like to join the conversation. Before I get into the interview, Hugh, with everything you've been through in your journey, what are your thoughts about the story I just read and the heinous crime that this young brother committed?
Yeah, you know, a lot of things. Every time I hear stories like this, it gives me a heavy heart, especially listening to the victims. They were the age that I was when this happened to me. A lot of times when I was inside, I would talk to a lot of guys, and as they were in there for different type of crimes, whether it was shooting someone or whatever, and they would talk, and we would get down to it, and they would realize that the whole thing that brought them there was based on miscommunication and not knowing how to communicate effectively. And in listening to that story, just asking how tall he was, there was something wrong. There was a disconnect there. And, you know, these stories always make your heart heavy because when our boys, when our sons, you know, when they go out, we have to think about, okay, well, they're a target all around the board from their own, from those who, from police, from whomever, you know, it makes your heart heavy. It really does.
Yes, it really does. It broke my heart as the mother of a black man. I just wanted to hear your opinion. Mm-hmm. First, I want to extend my condolences for the horrific death that your mother experienced. My heart was just so heavy when I read your story. And I was just wondering, is it difficult for you to talk about your mother?
No, it's really not. And the reason why it's not is because I sat in prison for 20 years screaming at the top of my lungs that I was innocent. And no one could hear me or no one wanted to hear me. I'm afforded the opportunity to still be of healthy mind and body, and I'm here to tell a story. So this is therapeutic for me to be able to talk about her and to make people make sure that they remember her name and, you know, remember everything about her. So it's not difficult. It's needed.
Wow, good. Well, I'm glad that you were able to not have resentment and be angry about it.
Mm-hmm.
Were you her only child?
From my mother, I'm the only child, yes.
Oh, wow. Were you a mama's boy?
I really was. And, you know, what's interesting is that, you know, I'm born in 72. When the year I was born, my mom was approaching maybe her 44th birthday. And she was here as a registered nurse. So for 1972, the chances of a woman saying, you know, I'm looking to have my first child are very slim to none. So me coming along, I think she really, like, we just really drew very close to each other. So we pretty much did a lot of things together, man, you know.
Oh, okay.
We did a lot.
What's her father's? I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was finished. I'm sorry.
What's your fondest memory of your mom?
one of the fondest memories of her is I remember the first time, I think I may have been about 12 or 13 years old. And it was around my birthday. And she took me out and said, okay, you know, you're turning into a man now for whatever that was worth. And took me out to buy some cologne and things like that. But, you know, it was just a lot of those small things that she would do. It just really made me feel like real special. And, you know, after she was gone, these are some of the things that I really remember, some of those small things. But, yeah, taking me out just to do small things like, you know, you're turning into a man now. Let me get you some cologne to put on. So that was one of the ones. Yeah.
Oh, that is so special. Was your father a part of your life?
Yes, my father was a part of my life all the whole way through. And what's so special about him? As I said, my mom was 43 going on 44. My dad was closer to 50 when I was born. You know, both parents are Jamaican. So his concepts and ideas on rearing and raising children were a bit different. You know, his idea was, you know, I go out, I make money, I provide, and, you know, your mother does the other stuff. So he was there. And even after this, he really, really demonstrated what a father is and what a man is supposed to do when his child is in need. And his life savings he used in trying to help me prove my innocence. And, you know, he never saw it all the way through, but very, very special guy, very special.
Oh, I know that meant a lot to you, especially for him to be there and, you know, be your support system through that. So, Hugh, let's go back to when you were 16 and this happened. Can you take us back to that day? Can you take us back to the actual day?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, I mean, it was the first day back from the holiday break. My mom, she was just starting a 2-week vacation from work. My dad was in Jamaica at the time visiting his mom. I believe there was a hurricane some months before that. So he was checking on her well-being. So, you know, the day started as normal as any other day. My mom woke me up. I got up, washed, ate. And I remember the last thing I said to her, she was sitting on the couch as I was leaving. And I said, you know, I'm going to try to make this semester a little better. You know, I was really losing interest in school. It really wasn't challenging for me. So I said, well, you know, I'll do better. And she knew that, you know, what I was capable of doing. So she kind of just smiled and said, okay, I'll talk to you later. I left and went to school, which I, you know, I stayed most of the day. I left, I walked home, and I noticed that her car wasn't in the driveway. So assuming that she's just starting this vacation, I'm sure she might have wanted to go out and do some shopping. So I said, I'm sure she'd be back soon. As I'm going into the apartment, I can hear the phone ring. It was a girlfriend of mine at the time. So I just, like, opened the door, and the phone was right as you open the apartment. I pick up the phone. She asked me if I wanted to come by and hang out. So I said, sure. You know, my mom wasn't there. I just pretty much turned around, closed the door, and left. I stayed around her place until about 5:30 and came home. I noticed the car was still gone. So, you know, living in New York, as you know, 5:30, it's January 3rd, it's getting dark. So I come inside. I take off my things and say, okay, well, she should be back any moment. So I'm walking towards my bedroom, and I notice that my parents' bedroom, the door is ajar. The door is partially open. I thought that was a bit strange because, you know, usually when no one's in the house, we usually close doors. I went into the room, and I found my mom. She was face down on the bed. She had been stabbed to death. I went to grab the telephone to call the police. I'm screaming. And I grabbed the phone. Went to call the police. But as I grabbed the phone, I noticed that there was no cord from the base of the phone to the receiver. they had taken the cord and they had bound her wrists with that. So I ran out to the phone in the hallway. I called the police from there. And from there, I couldn't go back in the room. So I ran outside just to wait for the police to come. When they came, I just told them, my mom is upstairs. My mom, you know, just tell them she's upstairs. So they went upstairs. From that point, it's just things became like a blur. I can just hear the distinct chatter of like radios and stuff like that. And they're asking me my whereabouts for the day. I told them everything. They asked me if I noticed anything was missing or out of place. I said, our car is not here. They brought me down to the precinct, asked me about my dad. I told him my dad was in Jamaica. Did I have a number to call him? I called him immediately. He jumped on a plane, the first plane he could get from Jamaica back to New York. He was on his way. In the meantime, they brought me back to the house to see if, you know, any, you know, if I could look around again. And again, I told him, you know, just the car that I noticed. So they told me if I had any place to go. I had a godmother that lived not too far in Mount Vernon. And so they brought me there. From there, I just stayed in the bed. I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. On January 5th, the officers called and said they wanted to bring me back down to the precinct. They wanted to give me a polygraph test. I didn't have the energy or to get out of bed, but I wanted to know what happened, and whatever they needed, I said, okay, well, I'll go. They came and they picked me up, brought me back down to the precinct. They asked me again my whereabouts for the third. I told them everything. Maybe about close to 2 hours into this, it went from, well, just, you know, tell us about your day to we have evidence that makes us believe that you committed this crime. Immediately I start crying. I'm asking for my dad. I'm saying, I have no idea what you're talking about. And they're telling me, you know, we know, and this is going to go much better if you tell us what happened. So at this point, I mean, I'm just crying in there. And they asked me again about my girlfriend. And so they said, oh, well, you know, we went to talk to your girlfriend, and your girlfriend, she's about 2.5 years younger than you. So do you know what that is? I said, I don't know what that is. They said, well, that's considered statutory rape. I never had heard the term before. I had never had any interaction with police. So, you know, I didn't know any of these things. And they said, well, if you don't tell us that you committed this crime, not only are we going to lock you up for this crime of killing your mother, but we're going to lock you up for statutory rape as well. But if you tell us you did this because we know it was an accident, we won't lock you up for statutory rape, and your dad will be able to come and pick you up from family court because we know that this was an accident, and, you know, we're going to help you. We just, you know, we want to help you get through this. This goes on for hours. And in that, you know, I was made to feel as if I did not say that, I was not going to be allowed to leave that room. At 16, I'd never been in an interrogation room. I'd never even been questioned by police. So, you know, this whole thing was traumatizing to me, coupled with the fact that I still can't process that I just went to school and left my mother on the couch talking to me, and we were talking about doing better this semester, to come back hours later to this. So I'm not there. And they kept at it for hours. And finally they got me to write out this confession of what they thought the series of events happened. So they charged me with my mom's murder, and they had it on every news outlet throughout the city and outside of the city. Mind you, as I'm leaving the precinct and they had me going through this perp walk, I'm so naive, I'm still thinking I'm on my way to family court. My dad is going to come pick me up. While these cameras are flashing and people are screaming at me, why did you kill your mom? So they put me in the back of the car and they're driving me downtown to downtown Bronx. And when I started to realize that, okay, something is, this is really off. They had the radio on and 1010 Winds was on. And the story that they just had me fabricate, I'm listening to this reporter say the same story. And I said, okay, this is not good. My dad, you know, they didn't tell me that my dad and other family members who had assembled in the Bronx, they were in downstairs in the precinct, and they wouldn't let them. They told them I would be down in a minute, and they didn't tell me that anyone was downstairs for me. So, again, I get arrested, charged, indicted. I fight for 2.5 years. My dad is just every penny he ever had. He's just putting towards my defense. And finally, in 1991, I was sentenced to 15 years to life. I went upstate. We were still appealing, still just trying to find anything we could get to, you know, get this case reopened, be heard. But to no avail. And as years started to go on, I can visibly see him getting older and getting weaker, and, you know, he can't really press on as much as he did. And, you know, unfortunately, by this time you're talking about, I have 8, 9, 10 years inside prison. So sadly, this has become the norm for me, although I'm still fighting to get out. So there is a lot going on. Finally, in 2005, my dad, he passed. And what was so sad about that? But what was so sad about that was the last time I had saw him was 2003. And they brought him up from Jamaica because he had to end up selling a house and the whole nine. So they brought him up for some type of health care, some type of service he needed, and he could only get it in the States. But by the time they brought him up to see me, Alzheimer's and stuff like that had ravaged him. He didn't know who I was. So, I got out in 2009, but, you know, just getting out wasn't enough. There was still a story to be told. There was still a truth to be uncovered. So all of the writing and the attorneys that I would reach out to over the years, they had finally paid off. And there are some attorneys who had actually said, okay, we're willing to take a look at this. And that set off another 10-year fight. And finally, 2019, January, I was exonerated. But there are so many twists and turns to this story, the things in which they did, the lengths in which they went to keep the truth suppressed. They knew the fact, they knew the truth less than 2 weeks after they arrested me, but it took us 28 years to actually uncover what they knew. And for me, therein, that's the only crime that happened here, what they did. And so, again, I don't think that they anticipated that I would survive the whole sentence. I don't think, you know, especially not in a healthy mind, you know, and I definitely don't think that they, you know, thought I was going to come and still say, no, you did something wrong to me, and I'm willing to fight to prove it. I don't think they anticipated that. So I guess I'm duty-bound to do what I'm doing now, you know.
Yes. So in 2009, when you were released, but you weren't exonerated at that point. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, so you were released after doing how many years? I mean, so they just released you, what, you made parole? Is that what happened in 2009?
That's what happened in 2009. After 6 attempts at the parole board, remember, I was sentenced to 15 years to life. I ended up doing 20 years, 8 months.
Wow.
You know, right, because you see, when they say okay, well, he did 19 years. No, the 19 years is from the time they sentenced me. this case was already close to 3 years old when I was sentenced in 1991. This case was from 1989. So in totality, it was 20 years and 8 months I did. I was sentenced to 15 years to life. But because of the administration that we were under in New York, they said violent felons should not be released at the time. And my case was someone, I guess they looked at as, well, this is someone that we should never release. You know, so it took me multiple attempts at doing it, still at the same time writing people and, you know, trying to get people involved in the case to get this, you know, heard or get it back into a court. And finally, I think maybe about 6 or 7 months before I came home on parole, there were attorneys that said, well, we're interested. We want to take a look at it. And they said, you know, if when you come home, you still want to fight, we're here. So for me, it was a no-brainer. This was never my burden to carry. So, you know, I knew that we had some fighting to do. And it took the next 10 years for someone to say, okay, you know, we made a mistake and, you know, we would like to correct it. Yeah.
Wow. Whew. What a story. Jesus. Wow. Wow, that's a lot. That's a lot. So were you charged as an adult?
I was charged as an adult at 16. It was, you know, in New York, it's a very, when it comes to young black men, it has very, very interesting policies. And a lot of times people don't like to talk about it or like to say it like it's supposed to be said. But in 1989, it's important, like when we say, well, how did that happen? How does someone get arrested, charged, and convicted of a crime like that when they didn't do that? It's important to go back into that time capsule of 1989 and what the temperament of New York City was. I often tell people that I believe that that year there were over 2,400 murders in the city. People were scared. People were frightened. We were in the height of the crack epidemic, and people wanted to feel safe. Even if it was just the illusion of feeling safe, law enforcement realized that using that, they could do a lot of things. They had leverage to do a lot of things. And as a result, a lot of people were arrested and charged for crimes that they did not commit. For example, just to put things into perspective, my case happened January 3rd, 1989. Not less than 90 days later, they arrested 5 young men in Central Park. And those are the cases that made the newspaper. Now, there are many other cases where people were just getting things put on them that weren't supposed to during that time that never made the papers, some still languishing in prison right now. But it was the time. And in order to understand that, like I said, it's important to understand the temperament of the city in 1989. So that's how those things were really allowed to happen. Hello? Hello? Hello, hello? 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 Hello, hello?
Hugh?
Hello? Can you hear me?
Hugh?
Hello? Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I'm sorry about that. So,
okay,
so you're 6. Okay, sorry about that. So you're 16 years old. And, I'm sorry?
Yeah, I'm here. I can hear you.
Okay. Okay, so you were 16 years old, and you went into an adult prison, and you just witnessed, you know, you just saw your mother. How did you maintain your sanity? What was going through your mind at that point?
You know, the first few months, it was extremely traumatizing to go from not knowing anything about this type of a lifestyle to being thrust into the worst of the worst, you know what I mean? And I believe that for me, two of the things that really kept me going or helped me to keep my sanity, one, knowing that, okay, I'm standing on the side of truth here. They're gonna figure this out. This is a mistake. You know what I mean? I was at that phase, although I'm traumatized by seeing what's, you know, the things that are going, that's going on in prison. And it's like, okay, I'm not cut from any of this stuff. But I'm saying to myself, I know that, you know, they're going to realize that this was a mistake. I was in school at the time. They're going to realize this. And my dad, to see him, to see how he just said, okay, I have to make sure that he is okay. I think out of this story, and I speak about him, I think that he really doesn't get the credit that he deserves, because you had the burden of taking care of your son when the whole city was saying you should just leave him for dead. And on top of that, at the same time, you had the responsibility of burying your wife and dealing with all of her affairs and all of her things that she, you know, all of her paperwork and all of the stuff that, you know, constituted the two of, you know, both of your lives together. And then you still had to say, okay, well, I still have to make a living for myself and I still have to press on. And you do that stellar for the next 13 years until you eventually pass. So those kind of things, I saw that from 1989, from sitting on Rikers Island. He was just relentless, and that gave me the strength to say, okay, do your part. Do your part. We're going to get through it. So, yeah, it's those two things, just knowing the truth and having him.
Wow, you are strong. Oh, my gosh, you are definitely a testimony. We have a caller. Caller, are you available? Are you there? Caller? Okay. So, call back. Press 1 and try to get back in, caller. I just really commend you for just being being able to sustain yourself through those difficult times and those difficult years. I mean, just the fact that, you know, you lost your mom in such a tragic way, and then, not being able to attend her funeral, and, you know, for them to even imply that you did something like that. I was going to ask you, like, you were coming from school, so like you said, they had, they were able to verify that you were in school that day.
Great question. So, when they went to my school, they asked my teacher, I guess once they said, okay, well, this had to have taken place around this time. So they went to my school, and my teacher initially, when she looked at her, login, she eventually ended up saying that she marked me in the wrong place. So she said, oh, no, I don't have him down. Two, maybe 3 days later, she called the precinct and talked to the officers and said, I made a grave mistake. He was here. The third fell on this day, which was the first day back to school. She said, no, I've marked it in the wrong place. No, he was here. I remember he was here. And she put this in writing. And also, not only a phone call, put this in writing. they decided that they were going to hide that because that put me in school. So now, here's why they had to go to those lengths to hide that. It's because on the day of my mom's funeral, remember there was a lookout for the car because that's what I say, somebody has the car. Mm-hmm. So on the day of her funeral, the Mount Vernon police call the police in the Bronx and say, hey, that car, we found that car. So the officers go from there up to Mount Vernon and say, okay, we're going to really close this case off. We're going to, you know, wrap this whole thing up. So they get there, they say, okay, well, you know, who has the car? It was our downstairs tenant who they had in the car. So now at this point, they had a problem because I'm on the cover of every newspaper and you're saying that I admitted to you, I committed this crime because I owed someone money for a drug debt and I sold the car as a result of that. But now you have the guy, in which, one of the guys in which you questioned on a third, he's in possession of the car on the 11th or the 12th. You have a problem at this point. So any evidence that came that would prove that I was in school and I had nothing to do with this, they made sure they doubled down on covering that. And as I said, it took us 28 years to find some of that stuff. And, you know, I don't know how some of that stuff made it through all these years to come to my attorney's desk, but I don't discount the power of spirit. I just know that there was stuff that people tried to really hide from us.
Right, of course.
It just land like right there, say, okay, here is the final piece of the things in, that you need. This is what they did.
Wow.
You know, it was humbling. It's not, and I want to say this too, you know, it's not just my strength to endure all of this. It is the network of people who were assembled around me for the last 30 years. The defense that I had, phenomenal guy. A lot of people don't, you know, may or may not know him, but probably one of the best defense attorneys in the country at the time, it was William Kunstler. But they were so, again, as I said, so hell-bent on saying, we're not going to allow this to come out, that this child is innocent. It didn't matter who was at the defense table. They were going to make sure that I was convicted of that. But from those times, I've managed to have people around me that held a genuine interest and wanted to get to the truth. So it's just not me. A lot of times me staying strong is knowing that I have people that depend on me staying strong and them, you know, and vice versa. So it's all of those things. It's definitely not just me.
Wow. Such a blessing, man. Such a blessing to have that support system. I believe we have a caller. Caller, are you there? Hello. So did you have a lot of family support as well during this process? I know you said you had a lot of, you know, attorneys and stuff like that that were around you.
I did. I had family support. My dad's side of family most are concentrated in Jamaica and England. So, you know, our communication pretty much throughout my whole ordeal was through letters, and you know, I got a lot of support with them through that. My mom's side, there's a lot that are concentrated in New York. Throughout the years, you know, I would see them, and you know, when it came time to go to parole boards, you know, they were there and writing and saying, look, you know, he needs to be released. And it was just having a great network of people. But most important, people who know that you shouldn't be there, you know. So that makes the support even stronger, you know, when they know that you're really not supposed to be here. So.
Right, and it's such a blessing to have, you know, to have that support system. So, how did you connect with the Innocence Project?
Great question. As I said, even from the time.
Oh, wait a minute. Hang on one second. The caller is ready. I believe the caller is ready now, Hugh. Caller, are you available? Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Hello? Hello?
Yes,
hello?
Go ahead, caller.
Okay. Good evening, ma'am. This is really, really, really touching to hear. I'm really interested in what Mr. Burton has to say about something he alluded to earlier when he spoke about the climate in New York at that time, 89, the height of the crack epidemic. People were really afraid. The climate in New York was really tense. It was nerve-wracking. People were afraid. They were afraid to be out. They were afraid of, I dare say, black people. So with something that happened as gripping as that, it's really easy to see how people felt that way. And my question goes on to ask Mr. Burton, knowing the climate right now, as it stands right now in race relations in America,
mm-hmm.
can you correlate what happened in that climate in 1989 to the things that are going on today?
The climate in 89 is a direct result of things that were set into play maybe a decade and a half before. So it's important to first start there. Although I was a little guy, when we start talking about the mid-70s, the city of New York was bankrupt. Anyone who was around New York at the time, around 77, the city was bankrupt. By the time Jimmy Carter made a walkthrough in the Bronx, it was like him as well as Reagan, like they didn't even, like some of them were like, yo, this is, people actually live here. So you fast forward from that, and then you get into the 80s. And then you look at black people, you look at the condition of black people. We were in a very, 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 very bad state. So as a result, anything that you have where people are in a bad state, a state of desperation, we can say what we want. Crime is a byproduct. It's going to be a byproduct of that.
Mm.
So as you go through the 80s and then you get the introduction of this cheap form of a high, you get about 85, 86, it ravages the city. From users and those who are selling, it ravages everything in the city. So by the time 89 comes, people, as you said, and as I said earlier, people are literally terrified. So how does that correlate to what's going on right now? The interesting thing now, the same things are pretty much happening, but we're looking at things through the lens of everyone has a phone. We can see all of the aspects of 89 in 2020. We can see everything. In 89, we couldn't really see too much. We didn't have phones. We didn't have access to so much information. 2020,
right.
The only difference is we have access to a lot of this information. If we had access to the information in 89 that we have now, there is no way you can convince people that I woke up one day and I was high and I just, you know, out of the clear blue said, you know what, I'm going to go from 0 to 100 and I'm going to kill my mom. We couldn't, you can't make people believe that now.
Right.
You know, it's
right.
It's just,
right.
People are going to say, I need more. you got to give me more. That doesn't wash. But for 1989, it washed. We didn't have access to so much information. So in answer to your question, not much has really changed from then to now. It's just we are able to see more, we question more, and we know a little bit better.
Sadly enough, and I'll be really brief. Sadly enough, Mr. Burton, I really agree because Hillary Rodham Clinton, during the course of history from 89.
Caller, I'm sorry, I have to cut you off. We have other callers, and thank you so much for calling. Please continue to listen in on the show. We got to wrap it up, okay? Thank you so much for calling.
Yes.
Okay, so I want to get to a couple of these questions. We have 15 minutes left. I'm sorry, I had to cut the caller short.
Okay.
So listen, I was going to ask you about connecting with the Innocence Project because I want to get the people on the listeners to maybe wondering what the process was or whatever. What can you tell them about how you came in contact with the Innocence Project?
Well, the way I came into it was very non-traditional because I was writing them while I was still inside, and I did get an answer back, and they were telling me that, you know, I didn't have any issues of DNA, which was what the Innocence Project primarily focused on, cases that there were questions of issues of DNA. So I think someone had gotten a letter from me sometime before, and I guess they were like, well, you know what, that they're going to forward my letter. They forwarded my letter to Northwestern Law Clinic, which deals with coerced confessions with juveniles.
Okay.
And when they got a hold of it, they looked at the case, and I think, you know, if you know you were old enough to remember, there's certain things that you remember about the case. And they were like, okay, I think we remember this. They said, well, let's talk to him. I was still inside. So they had them, and they used the liaison with Rutgers Law Clinic. They took my case as far as they could take it, even after I got out, up until 2016. At that time, they had to go back to the Innocence Project and say, look, we have taken this as far as we can go. We need some help. They gave them everything that they had, and those three law clinics got together, and that's how I got exonerated.
Wow. Well, I'm telling you, sir, a good God. That was grace. You know, that was grace.
Listen,
that's such a blessing. Such a blessing.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I was saying I was saying it was real non-traditional how everything happened. So, you know, I was just writing. Pretty much, I just spent my time writing it to anyone that would be willing to hear me. You know.
You know, and the thing is, like, I'm just so in awe of your tenacity because even once you got out, you didn't just say, well, I'm out, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that,
mm-hmm.
and I believe, you know, a lot of people would just be thankful to be out. But you continued to fight because it was important for you to clear your name. You know, I mean, boy, I tell you, that is definitely a miracle. A miracle. That's a miracle right there. That all these people came together. That is definitely nothing but grace.
Right.
And you know, you've been through so much already, but you know, God is faithful, and I just really just am so awe of your story and how you stood in there and how you continued to fight. It wasn't just you just didn't let them continue to screw you over after all of those years, and I commend you. What would you say to brothers today that the family that may be listening and they know mm-hmm. that their loved one is also innocent? What would you say to mm-hmm. them?
Mm. To the family,
what can they convey to their loved ones to do?
You know, stress to them. There are going to be days where it seems like nothing is going to happen. That you're getting denied, or this motion didn't get granted, or you got to do this. Like, you know, they keep us jumping through hoops to, you know, to gain our freedom when they know the truth. Those days, y'all have to really double down and say, we know what the truth is and we're going to get to it. And you have to keep that determined idea that, listen, we're going to get to it. And those moments of weakness, you have to really, really support them. For instance, my dad used to come up on a visit sometime, and I, you know, in the early years, it was him coming up, making sure his, you know, his son was safe, because he knew his son was scared in an environment that he should not have been in. But as the years went on, now the visits become him coming up for advice, peace of mind, or just, you know, the roles switched. So I'm saying that to say there's going to be days where everybody's roles are going to be reversed. So the family, there's going to be days where you're going to have to lean on the strength of your incarcerated loved one. And there's going to be days where the incarcerated loved one's going to have to really lean on the strength of the family, because there's going to be weak days. There's going to be weak moments, but you got to press on. You got to, especially when you know you have truth on your side. That's all you got.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. So what can a family member do? What was the greatest thing that was that helped you in that process in terms of support? I want to maybe talk to the listeners so they can say, what would be the most valuable thing that they could do for their loved one that's in, wrongfully or rightfully, in terms of being supportive of them?
The people that have that are handling your loved one's appeal or whatever, or motions that they are filing for that, do not sit and say, they got it. They got it. You stay on their back. You hold them accountable, because this is the person who is interpreting what the truth is and what the family's feelings are. So you make sure you hold that person accountable. Stay on.
Yeah.
That's what you can do. When the person that's inside knows that my mom, my father, my cousin, my brother, my sister, whomever is gonna make those calls and stay on top of it. So every time I call, they got some news for me. All right, I ain't hear from them, but I left this or I left that. Just telling the dude that, yo, I left the email, and I'm if he don't get back, I'm gonna get back on top of him with that. A person to hang up the phone and go lock in and say, yo, you know what? Somebody's on top of it. Tomorrow's going to be a better day. Those little small things. For me, when they used to give out mail, they would give out mail around 4:30. One of the most emptying feelings is when the officer passes and they don't stop there and drop anything. It's an empty feeling, and it's a dangerous feeling, because if they come by enough times and they see that they don't drop anything there, okay, nobody checks for him, nobody cares about him. We can do with him as we please if need be.
Right.
You know? So
right. So the key is to make sure that they communicate with that person. Like sending letters and just being that is huge.
Absolutely.
That is huge. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was agreeing with you.
Yes, I mean my son was wrongfully incarcerated, and that's why that's how I got to, you know, become the activist and advocate that I am today. And he said one of the things that really really helped him was when I used to send daily devotions and scriptures and stuff like that, he would read it and pass it on. It's just so important to feed their spirits. We got to wrap it up, but I have a couple more questions I want to get in real quick. Are you still affiliated with the Innocence Project today? And if so, in what capacity?
I am. One, when you work and you all fight for something like this, something that has so much emotion attached to it, even after, we've got it overturned or we got the indictment thrown out, people become family, sort of, because it's like there was so much emotionally invested in that. Also, you know, a lot of the speaking engagements that I do get are through the Innocence Project. So anytime that they say, well, you know, we would like for you to come and speak over here, I definitely stay close to them with doing that, because it's important to get out what's going on with us. And sometimes it's better to have someone who's actually gone through it than to listen to someone who can just talk to you from points of law, you know. So
absolutely.
Yeah, so I'm grateful and I'm humbled to do that, man. For all that was done for me, it's really nothing, you know. And as I
right.
said, I'm duty bound, but that's how we're still connected.
Oh, that's amazing. So what's next for Mr. Hugh Burton?
What is next? You know, I really, really want to go back to school. As funny as that seems, and I want to go back to school for audio engineering. I'm actually a musician. That's what my dad was before he came here, and I, you know, he passed that on to me, and that was one of the connections that we had throughout the years in there. He was a sax player. I play keyboard, so he was kind of teaching me via phone while I was inside.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I kept at it, and I was saying to myself, you know, I really want to go to school and learn the audio part of, like, mixing and engineering. So that's one of the small goals that's next for me.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So are you from Jamaica, or your parents are from Jamaica?
My parents are from Jamaica. I'm first generation born here, born and raised in the Bronx.
Oh, okay. Have you been, since you've been home, have you been to Jamaica?
No, because what was interesting is that the first 7 years I was home, I was on parole. So I was unable to get a passport. So I've recently got a passport. So now that I got the passport, now I have to make sure that the finances are in line with that. I'm looking to go before the year is out, and hopefully we'll be back to normal in the country, and we'll be doing it, be able to do some traveling, and I'll be able to go.
Wow. Well, I just want to thank you so much, Hugh, for sharing your story, for coming on Injustice. I wish you well, much success, brother. Continue to keep your head up and be an example for other people. I admire your strength, and I just want to say again, thank you so much for sharing your story. You have a good evening, and you take care, my brother.
Thank you so much, and you have a great one, too.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
The story of Hugh Burton is one that is all too familiar to the black community. There are countless black men in prison for crimes they did not commit. Thank God for the Innocence Project and the work they are doing nationwide. It is giving many of them hope for brighter days. If you have a story of injustice you would like to share, or would like to recommend a topic for discussion on a future show, please DM me. I am author Melinda Robertson across all social media platforms. Next week's guest will be DC's own Clarence Miles, Executive Director of Uniting Our Youth. Thank you for tuning in. You have a great evening, and we will be back at it next Tuesday at 8 p.m. Thank you. Stay safe.
Brother, brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer. For only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love and kiss here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish
me
with truth. time. Talk to me.